just not enough. Oh, oh, man.
My loving God, can't get enough of your love, man. Girl, I don't know, I don't know why, can't get enough of your love, man.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noel Show. And now, your host, Gary Noel.
It's like the more you give, the more I want. And maybe that's no lie. Oh, no, man. Tell me.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noel. We have a lot to share with you today. All positive, insightful, and we're going to be asking for your feedback on our talkback on a couple of the topics a little later on in the program. We're going to talk about the latest on health and healing, of course, and how we can live longer lives. But then we're going to also look at the problems surrounding vaccines. We're going to hear from two separate families whose lives were ruined because they trusted that the vaccines were safe and effective, plus a commentary from a medical doctor who is concerned that other doctors are not doing their homework. They're not honoring the Hippocratic Oath of first, do no harm. We're also going to look at how the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, approves a synthetic marijuana for a company that spent a lot of money to keep regular marijuana off the market and make it illegal. We'll also look at how a healthy diet is good for the planet. And we're also going to look at how one more step in protecting our DNA from cellular aging. On our commentaries today from Julia Stach from The Guardian, U.S. jails are warehouses of sick, poor, and low-risk people. Yeah. And why should they be there? We'll explore why we're incarcerating so many people and we shouldn't be. What would be a better way to help them? Also in our schools, we now have a birth to prison pipeline. And one of the ways they get there is by not getting the quality education they deserve and could get. So why the conventional wisdom on schooling is all wrong? Valerie Strauss of the Washington Post shares some insights, and I happen to think that she's got some important things that we should consider. But I have a lot of commentaries today to share with you. So let's get right into what we're going to talk about, and let's get us healthier. First up, quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N, has been shown, based upon new research, to have strong anti-cancer properties. Now, yesterday I mentioned that there was research at the University of Electronic Science and Technology in China, published in Cancer Week, a highly respected journal showing this. But what they didn't show in here, and what I've seen from my own independent research, is that quercetin, you cannot get enough by eating it. You have to take it in supplemental form. I'm suggesting starting at 1,000 milligrams, 500 in the morning, 500 in the evening. After a month, go to 1,000 milligrams, then 1,500, 2,000, 2,500, 3,000. Now, that's for people who have no obvious disease, who are trying to live a rather healthy life. What can it do? Well, it can help lower your blood pressure. It helps thin your blood. It kills bacteria that you don't want in your system and viruses. It has anti-cancer properties. It protects your skin, and it's one of the major ingredients, along with vitamin C, for creating healthy collagen. So, in effect, it tightens the collagen in your face. So you're going to have the benefit of a more resilient, healthier, younger skin than people who try to fake it using Botox. And then they look, you know, they just look strange because they've paralyzed the muscles that the skin is draped over. The skin hasn't stopped wrinkling. It's just the muscles underneath have no longer the ability to contract. And as a result, you don't see any movement. But if you have collagen strengthened naturally, you can laugh and smile and have all your normal facial expressions, but your skin will be younger. So that's a natural way of having a natural facelift. And for those who have cancer, you'll want to take more vitamin C, approximately twice the amount of vitamin C as quercetin, and hence more quercetin several times a day. I'd be starting about 6,000 milligrams of quercetin in a total day and about 12,000 milligrams of vitamin C in that same day. A lot of people have trouble with their liver. I've mentioned many times that the health of the liver is supreme. When I've traveled to the Norwegian countries, like Sweden, for example, and Switzerland, you'll notice there that they have a lot of bitter drinks. The older people, not the younger people. Younger people drink colas and high fructose corn syrup in their beverages, but the older people still have that knowledge that the bitter herbs are terrific tonics for helping purify the liver. And they are right. I've seen as many as 150 different bitter tonics, each one different, each doing something different, that people have used. In America, you ask about a bitter, no one knows a single bitter. And yet we do have bitters also, it's just we're not using them. For example, watercress is a bitter. If you were to juice watercress, always wash watercress, and then you juice it, only about, let's say, an ounce, but that would be a great bitter for you to take. Arugula is a good bitter. So we do have some bitters. Chicory is a bitter. But over there, they're using different ones to cleanse the liver. Now, why? Because the liver is so important for our overall health. When you're taking high-protein diets, you're hurting your liver and your kidneys. So we take way too much protein in the American diet. This is from the University of Surrey in the United Kingdom, and it talks about damage caused to the liver by very low-protein diets, but these can be repaired. This was published in the journal Nutrition. And so what they're showing is that the liver is remarkable. You can regrow up to 60% of your liver. Hence, good news for people who've been on high-protein diets, low-protein diets, who've been drinking alcohol, who have viral implications such as hepatitis, all of which destroy the liver. If you're on a good quality cleansing program, if you're taking glutathione, alpha-lipoic acid, L-glutamine, all of these help regenerate the enzyme activity, antioxidant activity inside the liver. So repair your liver, and you can do it on a healthy plant-based diet with lots of juices, especially green juices. But there's more. I want to give you the best foods and herbs to reduce the risk of liver disease. I'm talking about any form of liver disease. And by the way, if you don't think liver disease is a problem, nearly 40,000 Americans die every year from liver disease. And some of the most common liver health problems are fatty liver disease, alcoholic liver disease, cirrhosis, hepatitis, toxicity from medications, and liver cancer. Environmental toxins and diabetes and being overweight also lead to liver disease. And liver disease gets triggered by poor lifestyle choices. And some of the signs and symptoms of liver health issues include dark-colored urine, itchy skin, yellow skin and yellow eyes, flu-like symptoms, and tenderness on the upper right side of the abdomen. Now, liver fibrosis is one of the stages of a decline in liver health. It is the third stage of alcoholic liver disease and can also be caused by hepatitis C. So avoiding all processed foods, sugar, fats, and alcohol, that's a given. Then a diet that maximizes phytonutrients, that's a given. So what should go into your diet every day if you want to have healthier liver? Spinach, kale, chard, collard greens, those are top of the list. Arugula and collard greens, those would be right up there. They're excellent at supporting liver health. Remember, the darker the leaf, the more flavonoids, antioxidants, and carotenoids, as well as vitamin C. But then those are leaf vegetables. Also good for the liver would be broccoli, which, as we know, is a cruciferous vegetable that protects the liver against fatty liver disease. And it also blocks the uptake of some of the toxic lipids. Blueberries. Once again, blueberries enters that pantheon of the 10 best fruits you can consume. And it's rich, rich, rich in flavonoids and anthocyanins. These compounds are known for their anti-inflammatory properties. Garlic. Garlic offers so many antibacterial properties, antioxidant, antiviral, antifungal, reduces inflammation in all your joints and muscles, the brains and the eye, kills pathogens. In fact, just last week, I had some visitors come by who are longtime friends, and this is a great chef, probably the greatest chef in America, and he wanted to cook a meal. I said, no. But I also didn't want to cook a meal. I just wanted to treat, so I took some of my brown rice pasta and some of the organic condiments that I wanted to be used, and we went to a restaurant, and which is good for the restaurant because it cost them zero, and they made $32 a plate. In any case, the dish was served, and it was rather bland and boring, and so I said, can you give us some Kalamata olives and lots of garlic? And they said, what do you mean lots of garlic? Like a teaspoon? That's a lot of garlic. I said, no, a cup. What do you mean a cup? You know, like a coffee cup. But instead of filling it with coffee, you fill the entire cup with lightly sauteed, not dark, not black, not burned, lightly sauteed garlic. You're going to eat a whole cup of garlic? I can eat a whole bowl of garlic. And have. So you ought to see how I eat a baked potato or some of the other dishes. My friends who, if you've ever been to a retreat, and in the kitchen in the morning, I make a special beverage that's rich in everything. They call it the $20 drink, because if you made it for yourself, it would run you $20 at your cost. If you bought it in a store, it'd be like $50. And I put everything in there. But then I make myself something different. One of the people looks, that looks like mud. Well, it's kind of black. It's very thick. And it probably tastes something like mud. But boy, is it good for you. Everything that I want in my body, it's all raw. And it's my primary meal of the day. Most people don't like to taste it. But if they only knew what it did for them. Well, in any case, when I'm also in there cooking, after I prepare food along with the chefs, I cook generally one or two meals during a retreat, but then I make myself an entire bowl, not a cup, a bowl of garlic. And then I saute that into a combination of brown rice and navy beans, and then I chunks of tomato, and then I use tarragon with anise and fennel, red Himalayan sea salt, and black pepper, fresh peppercorn, and then put some combination of almond oil, avocado oil, and olive oil on. And that's it. It's a whole meal, and it's delicious. But most people can't take a lot of garlic, just like most people can't take a lot of wheatgrass. It's funny because sometimes when I'm having my juice in the afternoon, if I do the show from my apartment, I have a studio in my apartment, I have a studio in my home, and I have a studio in my office. So wherever I'm at, I'm going to be able to do a broadcast because we have a little unit called a Comrex unit. Didn't used to have these. Used to have to do it by telephone, but now you have broadcast quality because, in effect, you have a miniature studio, and these Comrexes are getting smaller and smaller. In fact, virtually every one of the nearly 85 hosts of the Progressive Radio Network, we are now in the process of purchasing them Comrexes so that it'll increase the quality of their broadcast every day. In any case, I go up and take a walk. It's always good when you've been sitting for more than 2 hours, take a walk. And it's always good if you've had a meal to take a light walk, not fast, but just the process of walking enhances digestion, speeds up circulation, and increases the bioavailability of the nutrients. So never lay down after a meal. That's bad. Always get up and go for a walk. That's good. And it gets your peristalsis moving, the wave-like rhythmic movement, so food goes through your intestine better. There's better assimilation, better elimination. And so anyhow, once in a while someone will see this 16-ounce glass. What's that, Gary? Well, that's a juice to energize my blood, and it produces lots of good healing nutrients to my body. I'll have one of those. No, have 1 ounce. Well, if you're, I can drink it. I don't think you can. You have to develop a tolerance for this, and it takes a while. And once in a while, someone will, you know, be very bravado-like and say, I'll take one. So they go to drink it. And so I say, cheers, and we both start to drink it together. And after about 30 seconds, I'm looking in their eyes, and I see this kind of strange look like, I shouldn't have drank this. And then they kind of stop and try to smile, and then they say, excuse me a second. They run out the door, and they projectile vomited across the street. Don't try drinking more than 2 ounces of wheatgrass juice unless you're really used to it. And don't go up to the high doses unless your body can adapt to it. But once you get used to really healthy things, it's wonderful for you. So put your wheatgrass up there. And if you really want to spike your wheatgrass to help your liver, once again, we're helping the liver. Garlic helps the liver. Ginger helps the liver. Lemon juice helps the liver. So why not use ginger, lemon juice, or lime juice, either one, wheatgrass juice all together. 2 ounces of each one, 6 ounces diluted in 10 ounces of water. And that's really good for you. And then pineapple. Pineapple has great anti-inflammatory digestive enzymes. It helps you better metabolize your food. So if you have poor digestion, slow digestion, it will help, and it takes the stress off the liver. It's also good in potassium, magnesium, B1, and vitamin C. Turmeric. Turmeric is the best spice there is in nature. And it's loaded with curcuminoids. And those reduce inflammation in the brain, the kidney, the liver, and even increase bile production, which allows for more effective digestion. And then green tea. Green tea reduces the fat accumulation in the body. It's a great liver support. So now you have it. All the good things that help you with your liver. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Try to do. Bad luck fella's got to hold on you. Losing your money, about to lose your home. Done lost your woman and everything you own.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the program for empowerment. In fact, I was just thinking about this because someone was talking with me from PRN in New York. I'm out on the road doing our latest documentary. Something new, I'll premiere it this summer. And they said, you realize if you took 1 week's worth of your audience, unique listeners, not repeat listeners, you'd be speaking with a group of people that could fill Madison Square Garden, the Nassau Coliseum, could fill another 5 football fields in the United States. And yet you're sitting there at a microphone looking out at your backyard, not realizing that there are a lot of people listening. I'm fully aware of how many people are listening. I see the statistics. What I like is how many of those people every day will pass on information. They'll pass on an article. They'll pass on information. Hey, did you hear what Gary said today about what we could do for your liver? And then suddenly that information is shared, and that's how we forward everything along, word of mouth. So I thank the people in this audience who get information and share it with others to enhance the quality of their lives. And isn't that what we're on this world for? To help others, to be in service to everyone else, especially those who need a hand. I see people walking by, people all the time, that they could stop. They could bear witness to what that person's about. Doesn't mean they have to change everything in their lives, but we can do a lot within our power to make life a little better for those in need. I posted some videos about that this week. Go to my Facebook page and look at the last 2 days, and you'll see people, just regular people, doing things for other people. And it gives you this sense of people are okay. Sure they are. We just don't pay attention very often to the people who are okay and doing good things. We spend an inordinate amount of time paying attention to people who are not. Now, I'm going to share some different short stories with you. These are all short. I'm not going to do the whole story, just enough to let you know that there's a story here that we haven't heard about, that wasn't in the mainstream media, that isn't in anyone's talking points, but is still relevant. Think about the different topics I'm going to go through rather quickly, and then we're going to go to a break. When we come back from the break, I'd like for you to call in on our talkback segment, and I'll give you that number, 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888, and take any of these topics you want and give us your input. I always value the input of people in the audience. Ready? Here we go. This is for short commentaries. This is from Valerie Strauss of the Washington Post, and she is reporting on a Marion Brady story. She said, quote, I've spent a lot of time trying to pinpoint the root cause of poor school performance. Here's a theory. Because education policy in America is made by non-educators in state legislatures and Congress, it's shaped by the conventional wisdom. The conventional wisdom says schooling is primarily about, quote, delivering information. The conventional wisdom is wrong. Delivering information is not the problem. Kids are drowning in information and oceans more of it at their fingertips, ready to be downloaded. What they need, that traditional schooling has never given them, isn't giving them now, and isn't information, but information processing skills. They need to know how to think, how to select, how to sort, how to organize and evaluate and relate and integrate information to turn it into knowledge and knowledge into wisdom. How do kids learn information processing skills? Well, the same way they learn to walk and read and swim and write and catch a ball and keyboard and ride a bicycle. They learn by doing. Learn to process information by processing information. Yes. What delivered information gives kids is about as interesting and intellectually challenging as crossword puzzles with all the squares filled in. They can't do anything with the information except try to store it in memory. And not having thought through for themselves the delivered information to a useful level of understanding and having no immediate use for it, it goes into short-term memory, then disappears. We're kidding ourselves if we assume those A grades being hung on American schools based on scores on standardized tests means that the students who attend them are being taught to think. We're kidding ourselves if we assume that the high test scores of students in Finland or Poland or South Korea mean they're being taught to think. Standardized tests are sideshows on the periphery of effective schooling because they can't evaluate original thought, without which humankind cannot adapt to continuous change and survive. What matters is our individual and collective ability to make sense of the world as it is and could be, and the means to that end are far varied and complex to be measured by machine-scored tests. There is a solution to the problem. Choose any idea in any school subject for which a solid case can be made that every kid in the country needs to understand it. And within the property boundaries of her or his school are the kinds of immediate, accessible, real-world prompts that allow that idea to be studied firsthand. The prompts just need to be identified and examined until they emerge from environment groups ignored because they're too familiar. Don't hold your breath waiting for acceptance of the obvious fact that direct experience teaches best. It's been 99 years since Alfred North Whitehead, in his presidential address to the Mathematical Association of England, said, "The second-handedness of the learned world is the secret of its mediocrity." Their administrators and teachers not only willing but powerfully motivated to move beyond today's emphasis on mere learned temporary recall of delivered information, but the system won't let them. The system, district offices, boards of education, state legislators, state bureaucracies, education publishers, chambers of commerce, colleges, universities, Congress, courts, philanthropic foundations, mainstream media, the system assumes that delivered information is what education is all about. So that's what gets taught and tested and scores treated as if they meant learning had taken place. It is gratifying to see the growing student, teacher, administrator, and parental resistance to the present misnamed reformed effect. Okay. I might mention that an outstanding educator, a principal, who has been fired now because this teacher, principal, wanted to give people, the student, an opportunity to learn about the real world from real life experiences, not just textbooks. And that was considered unacceptable. So I've given that person a radio show on the Progressive Radio Network called Good Teacher. And every week, teachers from all over the world will be able to and Skype and have conversations. We're going to begin a movement to take back the entire educational system. It may take time, but we have to start somewhere. The unions are corrupt. The system, the administration, the top-heavy emphasis upon the power structures, none of it works. It works for the people in power. It works for the privatization, for the test makers. It works for them. It makes them billions. But we are creating an entire nation in this generation of functional illiterates. They do not understand how to do anything in the real world. Your thoughts, your time for feedback. And again, in a few moments, I'm going to do some more now. And this is interesting. Whistleblower, you don't know about this. This is from Nafez Ahmed from Medium.com. Quote, "Whistleblower exposes how NATO's leading ally is arming and funding ISIS." Quote, "I am the police chief who was asked to guard ISIS terrorists." By the way, guard doesn't mean put them in jail and guard them. Guard means protect them. Turkey's intelligence chief, Hakan Fidan, named as a member of a terror group linked to Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Turkish intelligence directly supplied military aid to ISIS for years. Turkish government siphoned military supplies to ISIS through humanitarian relief organizations. ISIS fighters, including Al-Baghdadi deputy, received free medical treatment in Turkey and protection from Turkish police. The head of ISIS in Turkey received 24/7 protection under personal orders of President Erdogan. Turkey's police investigations into ISIS are being systematically quashed. ISIS oil is sold with complicity of authorities in Turkey and Kurdish region of northern Iraq. NATO affirms Turkey's role as an ally in war on ISIS. A former senior counterterrorism official in Turkey has blown the whistle on President Erdogan's deliberate sponsorship of the Islamic State as a geopolitical tool to expand Turkey's regional influence and sideline his political opponents at home. And the person is Ahmet Sait Yala, chief of the Counterterrorism and Operations Division of Turkish National Police, and became the chief of Public Order and Crime Prevention Division, and previously had worked in the Counterterrorism and Operations Division as middle-level manager for his entire 20-year police tenure before becoming chief of police in Ankara, and he gave this interview to Insurge Intelligence. And he exclusively revealed that he had personally witnessed evidence of high-level Turkish state sponsorship of ISIS terrorism during his police career, which eventually led him to resign. He decided to become a whistleblower after Erdogan's authoritarian crackdown followed the failed military coup a year ago, July. And this was the first time that the former top counterterrorism expert in the whole country spoke about what went on. So here's the takeaway message. We've told you this in the past. Many times in this program, I said that the United States, the National Security Agency, the FBI, all of the intelligence agencies and Homeland Security, they all are fully and completely 100% aware that our allies, including Turkey, who's a member of NATO, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, are all engaged in supporting the al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, ISIS, funding, weapons, hospitalization, all of that. And yet the American public thinks that somehow there's a group of fighters over there that we have to work with our allies to kill, and it's our allies who are funding them. So there is no possibility for ever ending the war on terrorism until we withdraw completely from the Middle East, close down our military bases, and especially in Afghanistan, realize that was the dumbest thing that could have ever been done, that intervention there. Longest war in American history, and we're right back where we started. The only way you're going to ever have peace in any Middle East country, especially Afghanistan, is when all the parties are brought to the table, and between them and their own classical and historical reference, they decide how they're going to cooperate and reconcile their differences. It is their culture, their religions, their body politic that is involved, not ours. And that's not about a matter of isolationism. It is about respecting other people who have worked with other people for a long time. And when we wanted oil, we wanted to have pipelines, we wanted natural resources, then we inserted ourselves and said, in the name of freedom, democracy, we are coming into this country. No, we've never gone into those countries. And by the way, last night on I think it was Tucker Carlson, the guy was mentioning how, you know, we can't allow Russia to interfere in our election. You know, that's almost an act of war. And Dick Cheney was actually quoted as saying it's an actual act of war when Russia intervenes in our electoral process. Well, Dick Cheney, I don't know if you've ever had a class in history, but let me give you one. I don't have time today, but I will tomorrow. I'll give you all 66 countries that we, the United States, intervened in their electoral process because we wanted our people in control. We wanted their resources under our control. And confirmed by the Confessions of Economic Hitman, who's been on this program, they either agreed to it or we killed them. So if you're unaware, Dick Cheney and all the other Tucker Carlson, Tucker, you're really beginning to disappoint me. I thought you had at least a modicum of the capacity to do independent research. So right then and there, you should have brought down on the screen a list of every country that we have invaded or gone in behind the scenes and changed governments to our need. And it's not speculation, it's not conspiracy theorists, it's historical fact. So, and why aren't we condemning Israel for being the number one spy in the United States? More than China, more than Russia. And we are spying on every single government in the world. Why don't you have that conversation? Why don't you bring in someone who's actually not a member of fascist Fox Network, the fascist conservative network? Why don't you actually bring into this stupid liberal network? Why don't you bring in someone who's just an independent ethicist and ask, how does it work that we can involve ourselves in every country in the world, know every secret, manipulate it, use it to our advantage, But the moment we find out that someone has been spying on us, we suddenly become, well, let's take a scene from the movie Casablanca, where Rick says to the Claude Rains, the police lieutenant, says, I'm shocked that there's gambling in your casino, as Rick hands him a wad of money. It's the stupidity, as if Americans are not supposed to know what the whole world knows. So now you've just gotten a brief, an exclusive brief, that the top man in all of Turkey has come forward and said that the Turkish government, our ally and NATO member, is right beside Saudi Arabia for supporting all of the terrorist organizations in the world out there. So good luck trying to wrap your mind around how we can continue to say we have a war on terror unless we also have a war on Saudi Arabia, a war on Israel, a war on Turkey, a war on economic, or however you want. Not a hot war, but boy, do we have it wrong on that. And one more here. Does the Bill Gates funding of media taint objectivity? This is from the Seattle Times. I'm not a fan of Bill Gates or his foundation because of all the things, their eugenic movement, their idea of depopulation, which he's actually made comments about how the world has too many people. Fine, Bill, then why don't you and your family and all the other billionaires, multimillionaires, why don't you and all members of Congress decide that you no longer should be consuming the world's resources and set yourself aside on an island someplace? But it doesn't work that way, does it? And you supporting all these vaccines, do you have any proof that any vaccine that you've ever funded or created is actually safe? If so, show me. Show me a single study on the toxicology of each of the ingredients. I have a lot of studies showing that not a single one of those ingredients are safe. This is from the Seattle, from Sandy Dalton from and Christy Heim from the Seattle Times. Quote, better known for its battles against global disease, the Gates Foundation has also become a force in journalism. The foundation's contributions to nonprofit or for-profit media have helped spur coverage of global health development and educational issues. By the way, as an aside, Bill Gates is a big believer in privatized education, charter schools. But back to it. But some people worry that its growing support of media organizations blurs the line between journalism and advocacy. Did you catch the ABC Network's recent special on an incubator to boost preemie survival in Africa and a new machine to diagnose tuberculosis in the developing world? Perhaps you saw Ray Suarez's three-part series on poverty and AIDS in Mozambique on the PBS NewsHour, or listen to Public Radio International piece on the rationing of kidney dialysis in South Africa. Beyond their subject matter, these reports have something in common. They were all bankrolled by the Bill and Melissa Gates Foundation. Okay. Well, if anyone knew about Bill Gates' temperament and his history at the company he co-founded with Paul Allen, then you would know that it's volatile. He doesn't take input from people. He's a screamer. He's a thrower at baby temper tantrums constantly. He's a megalomaniac and an egotistical person, according to the people who work for him. And he is the sponsor of the largest vaccine program in the world. And that program is extremely dangerous. So then how objective would a PBS or NPR or ABC be if you, as a medical doctor, board certified in pediatrics, brought forth a case to show that there was neither safety nor efficacy in any given vaccine, let alone set of vaccines? Would you be able then to get that on the air if Gates was funding the program? Think of that. And that's what people didn't realize. Also, how about this? For those of you who thought that President Slick Willie, Obama, I'll give him credit. He was as slick as a nail going through Vaseline. And the smile, you know, the easygoing temperament. But when it came to transparency, wasn't he the one that said that we will have transparency, we will be the most transparent? Well, someone actually did some homework here. And I want to quote something from Ted Bridis from Yahoo, quote, an AP. The Obama administration set a record for censoring government files or outright denying access to them in last year, the last year he was in office, under the Freedom of Information Act, according to a new analysis of federal data by the Associated Press. The government took longer to turn over files when it provided any, said more regularly that it couldn't find documents, and refused a record number of times to turn over files quickly that might be especially newsworthy. It also acknowledged that nearly one in three cases that it initially, in its initial decisions to withhold or censor records, were improper under the law. So, here's a government that censored more documents, made them restricted than any other administration in history. But hiding secrets, hiding information, didn't seem to be one of the points that anyone criticized on. And this is the final one. This is from Sarah Lazar from Common Dreams. Cruel and inhumane, UN slams United States as the only nation that sentences children to die in prison. This is a special report from the special rapporteur, Juan Mendez, a United Nations human rights expert, strongly condemned the United States for being the, quote, only state in the world that still sentences children to die in to live a life of imprisonment without the opportunity of parole, thereby imposing cruel, inhumane, and degrading punishment. The special rapporteur on torture made the comments to a report to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva. Building from his previous censure of cruel incarceration practices in a nation that locks up more people than any other country in the world. And he said the United States' practice of imposing life sentences on children ruins the mind. And that's an understatement. Well, here's a comment. Here's something to think about. In Norway, they have one of the lowest recidivism rates in the world. That's because they assume that when a person's in prison for whatever cause, they shouldn't be there for long periods of time. They should be getting counseling. They should be getting the type of therapy and help that when they leave prison, they can become constructive members of society, which the majority do. And as a result, they don't punish the people. We don't help the people in prison. We punish them. In fact, I received a letter. Even though I'm on the road, my office once a week sends me, you know, where I'm, a destination I'm going to be in. One was from a former New York State senator who's in prison and has been sentenced, been serving a sentence. And he was one of the leaders of the Senate. And he was talking about how he listened to this program every day, and he's getting out, and he's learned a lot of lessons. And he says, your comments about how people are treated in prisons is accurate. It's cruel. It's vicious. And it does not support the type of opportunity to value life. Well, if people are going to get out of prison, they should, unless they've shown themselves incompatible with life out of prison, then our entire prison system should be changed. The latest study shows that 39% of all people in prison shouldn't be there. We're putting people who need mental health care in prisons. And then the guards, they're not trained in anything except brutality. They scalded one of these men to death. This man was not mentally competent. You can't take someone off the street because they're poor, put them in jail, and expect them to adapt to that prison system. We could do a lot better if we wanted to. The trouble is we've always thought that if someone broke any law at all, that they had to be punished. And then if you leave it to either the Democrats, especially the Clintons or the Republicans, their idea of punishment, unless it's to them, is sadomasochistic. They must find some kind of perverse excitement in knowing that they're putting people in a position that no human being should be in, solitary confinement for years on end. Who does this? This is medieval. Our entire prison system is corrupt. Our entire prison system is barbaric. Our entire sentencing, our judicial is corrupt. Our entire system is corrupt. It's all one giant cesspool. Now go try to find some clean water in the cesspool and then come back and tell me who isn't corrupt, who isn't biased, who isn't a part of the problem. I'd like to see that person. I'd like to see the judge that says, well, you got to go to jail for 7 years because you had 2 ounces of marijuana on you. And yet the judge goes out with friends later and drinks alcohol that will actually kill their bodies. Do you get a degree in being stupid before you become a judge or a lawyer or a prosecutor or a legislator? What a sick system we have. Back in a moment with your input. Talk back. Come in right now. 888-874-4888. I've given you a lot of stuff to call in about. Your turn after these announcements. I'm Gary Knoll. Our phones are blasting away there. The engineer let that run along because he's answering about 100 calls. Thanks for calling in. We're going to take your calls in just a moment. I want to mention I've got a good thing coming up this weekend, Sunday evening, and it's from 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock, may even go longer. It's a special webinar, and if you call in. I'm going to give you a number to make it easy to get up there. Write this number down for listening in and watching on the webinar over your computer this Sunday evening. Call this number, 646-926-5435. 646-926-5435. Now, what are you going to learn? Well, first, you're going to watch the multi-award-winning documentary, Saving the Planet. Then I'm going to have a whole discussion about how do we survive what I believe and what a lot of other experts in the field believe will be happening that are already happening, but that might not have happened to you yet, like flooding, earthquakes, solar storms, fires. Where are the intentional communities? Do they work? Do they not work? 90% fail. Why do they fail? I'm going to explain why. Eco villages, do they work or not work? Where are they located? Where are the best places to live? Where's their water? Where's their less likelihood of being a problem in the future? Everything to survive the future I'm going to talk about. One time only. Plus, I'm going to have the most comprehensive list of information to help you. So when you're finished, it'll be absolutely downloaded to you. Plus, you're going to get 2 free copies of 2 documentaries also downloaded to you. So it's a terrific evening. It's Sunday. When our website is filled, meaning when our bandwidth is filled, then that's it. Our last one was filled, and we had thousands of people who tried to get on, couldn't. So you have a chance now. As of right now, there is room. Call 646-926-5435. Set aside from 5 to 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on Sunday when we're going to go into great depth on saving ourselves, our families, having a quality future, where a lot of people in this world, in this country, won't. And we're not talking about far future. We're talking about now and going forward. Also today, we sent out a wonderful special, and I don't have time to go into it, but I'll just tell you it's for someone who has spent their whole adult life in trying to understand the aging process and how to slow it down. I was ahead of the anti-aging research division of the Institute of Applied Biology for over 33 years as a research fellow. And I did more anti-aging experiments than anyone else I know of. And so I believe that we now know how to slow down and reverse many of the processes of aging. So we have 2 specials today. I'm not going to go into the ingredients. I'm just going to tell you the anti-aging elixir and Power Berry Blast are part of that whole overall protocol. You'd normally pay $144.99. You're only going to pay $86.99 for the two of them. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. That's our new special for the week. It's called the Fountain of Youth Special. And it's a good one. And also, today will be the last day that you'll be able to call. And we're filled up for the first week's retreat, and we only have one space left for the second week of a wonderful experience, the second week of April. If you want to come and enjoy yourself, detox, de-stress, if you want to cleanse, rebalance, look forward in a quiet, beautiful environment with good people, vegan food, exercising, wonderful classes and workshops, I'm going to give you a phone number. You can give a call. There's only room for one person left. Sorry, we can't take a couple right now. We're full. This is it. My last minute. Call 903-881-7008. 903-881-7008. That'll be the last retreat for the year. So hope to see someone say yes. You deserve it. Do it. Now let's go over to our phones. We ask you to call in, and let's say hello to Dave from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Dave. Your turn.
Hello, Gary. It's so wonderful to talk with you. I'm a retired teacher, and I want to weigh in on what they call education. But I, for the most part, say it's really training, not education, for many youngsters. And one of the things that they always leave out, these people who are demonizing all teachers, are the social and economic factors that weigh in on children, especially poor children who are suffering from poverty, nutrition problems, home disruptions, and neighborhood problems with gangs and all the other social problems exist, and those impact on how children learn in school. And these are usually ignored, and they usually just settle on demonizing teachers. Now, a couple months ago, I sent you a copy of my book that's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, Playing the Game. I don't know if your staff got it to you yet, but I'm a person that has been on your retreats in the past in Florida. And I know you know me. But the point is that I had an aviation program in a so-called ghetto area in Brooklyn. And people used to laugh at me because I told these students that they were going to be pilots. And today, my pilots are flying all over the world from the largest plane, the A380, the 747, and everything down. They're working for many airlines and whatnot. These are children that were in my class. And I see you made a good point. It's not just about getting knowledge to them. I did some of that in my classes, but most of the time with them, I empower them to survive in a hostile atmosphere in college and whatnot, and deal with the people who did not want them to be pilots. You know, it's just in the 1970s when they allowed the first black pilot, Marlon Green, to fly for airlines. Before that, they were not allowed. They didn't want women to fly for airlines. So that the black people who sued opened the door, and that allowed white women to get in also. So the point is, it's not just about stuffing children's heads with some knowledge to pass a standardized test. It's education should be about empowerment, to empower the children to do what they can to get knowledge and go
Dave,
on their own.
Dave, we appreciate that. So we just learned something new. You are one of the first teachers in a ghetto area to work with inner city children to inspire them to become pilots, and they have become pilots. We didn't know that. We commend you for that. That is terrific. Thank you for calling in, Dave. Let's go over and say hello to Wesley from Ocean Grove. Hi, Wesley, your turn.
Well, your truth score today is 100%. Excellent. The public schools cannot be reformed. Our governor in New Jersey was right one time. He said that the NJEA is a gang of thugs. That's exactly what it is. You can't teach, students can't learn to be independent thinkers from them who are intellectual invalids and mental midgets. The homeschool is the only future. The public schools will become citadels of the mental midgets and intellectual invalids. There are three features of independent thought. Number one is literacy. Literacy is progressive, and an important feature is the acquaintance with great literature. That is a separate subject. Independent thought benefits from a knowledge of true history, not textbook history, but true history, especially the facts about the foundations of America and our star founders, Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, and Madison. The truth about them, which is America was founded as a homeland, not an empire. Another aspect of independent thinking is civics. Schools do not teach civics. Civics would include monitoring of the politicians, calling the politicians to account, and when they do not do that, replacing them. That's what Jefferson intended from the beginning. We have lost this, and we have lost this totally. The only future is in the homeschool. If I had a son, I would have to homeschool him. He would be writing books in the 11th grade, or my equivalent of the 11th grade, books about corruption and books about independent living and living hundreds of years with purpose.
Wesley, my daughter homeschooled her children, and then when they went to college, they ended up being extremely well-balanced, healthy, happy, didn't have to process anger and resentments and act out. And so I certainly support homeschooling with the hope that the parent themselves is educated enough, wise enough, patient enough, disciplined enough to create even a greater living vocabulary for the child so they can learn how to apply that knowledge, language, and results in the real world. Thank you very much for sharing that. I appreciate it. Now, I'm going to finish our program today with a clip, a short clip, to show you what happens to all those millions of people in this country who are now victims of one of the worst public health frauds in history, and that is that vaccines are safe and effective for everyone who takes them, and therefore we should mandate them and everyone should be forced to take them.
I'm Ginny Bleski, and this is my daughter Mia, who's 12. On the 21st of September last year, 2016, she had the first HPV vaccination at school. The following morning she woke up and she couldn't walk on her legs. She couldn't wait there. Her legs were shaky and she had burning in either side of her spine all the way up her back. We took her to the doctors. They said, take her home and give her some paracetamol and put her in the bath. She'll be fine. But she deteriorated by the afternoon. So we recalled the on-call doctor who said, just go straight to A&E. We took her straight to A&E and they admitted her for a few days. We've done video diaries right from the first day all the way through up until now. And basically within about 10 days of Mia having the vaccination, she completely lost the use of her legs. A couple of weeks after, she lost the use of her body went floppy. At each stage we've gone in and out of hospital, so she's been just finished her fifth admission in 6 months. And we brought her home from that one. So her body went floppy, and then she lost the use of her neck, and then one arm, and then the other arm. And the right arm was the last one to go, wasn't it? So for the last 13 weeks now, she's only been able to blink and speak. She can't use any of her limbs. She's incontinent. And it's hard. It's really hard to see your child who was singing and acting and wanting to be in the West End and go to the Brit School and enjoying sleepovers with her friends and doing all the normal 12-year-old stuff that she would do. And we just want her to be well. And we're just looking for somebody to help us find a recovery treatment for her, because we just haven't got one. We just don't know what to do.
I'll be reaching out to that family, because I do have some protocols that I believe could make a difference. The point is, where is anyone within the medical industrial complex taking responsibility for what has happened to millions of people in our country and around the world? I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.